RSV Academy. Talking about RSV with Harish Nair. Gaps and doubts about RSV knowledge.
Welcome to the RSV Academy podcast, the ultimate podcast in the field of respiratory syncytial virus. I am your host, Federico Martinon Torres from the University of Santiago, and today we have the privilege of speaking with Professor Harish Nair. Welcome, Harish. I hope you're doing great.
I'm good. Thank you, Federico, and thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. So, based at the University of Edinburgh, Professor Nair is a leading epidemiologist whose work has significantly contributed to our understanding of RSV. His research has been instrumental in shaping global health policies and has provided invaluable insights into the epidemiology, burden, and prevention of RSV. He leads several large collaborative projects on global child health and infectious disease, and very specifically on RSV, like PROMIS, RESCUE, or RSV Gene. And he's also co-founder of RSVNet, and very importantly, a good friend of mine. So all in all, it's an absolute pleasure to talk today with someone like Harish about RSV. So Harish, I will fire first, and my very first question has to do with RSV as a serial killer, which I think it's out of discussion, and everybody more or less has the idea that RSV is a serious killer. But my question is, do we really know how many deaths RSV actually causes every year?
So that's a very good question, Federico. I don't think we know the true number, but we do know that in the children, it causes a substantial amount of mortality. So based on modeling figures, what we know is that it causes between 104,000 to 229,000 deaths in under five children. But that is likely to be substantially underestimated, because these are direct mortality from RSV. And again, remember that these are based on studies that have been either conducted in hospital and then that have been put into the model and then that has been extrapolated, or based on deaths in the community, but then these studies are few and far between and were only conducted very recently. So again, we don't know exactly, you know, what the true number is likely to be. But even with these underestimates, what we do know is RSV accounts for every one death in 50 deaths within children under the age of 5 years. So one in 50 deaths in children under the age of 5 years, that is 2% of all under five mortality, is from RSV. And again, one in every 28 deaths in children age younger than 6 months is as a result of RSV. So these are directly attributable deaths. So that means 3.6% of all cause child mortality under the age of 6 months is attributable to RSV. So as an infectious diseases cause, RSV is second only to malaria in terms of child mortality. And majority of these deaths are occurring, 97% of these deaths are occurring in developing countries.
Well, I mean, clearly the figures that you provide, and actually are the figures that you and your group are generating in this regard, are the hallmarks, no, that we all are taking into account when making calculations and estimations of the burden, cost effectiveness model, etc. But as you said, there may be some, let's say, gaps or underestimation in that regard. But my question is, do we really, or can we really do better? Because yes, you said that most of these are inpatient deaths, that for certain countries it's difficult to really account for accurate data. So my question is, do we have the means to actually have or obtain more accurate numbers in this regard?
Yes, we do. So one of the ways to understand and account for this mortality is to look at when you start implementing the vaccine, then you use the vaccine as a probe. So once you start vaccinating children, you can see and do a before and after comparison. And because we do know how many deaths occur. Whether we know the cause of the deaths or not, we do know that how many deaths occur in children in a given population, in a given country, because deaths are hard, right? So they can be counted. So if the deaths can be counted in a given location, and you introduce a vaccine, and then you see that the vaccine, post the introduction of that vaccine, the deaths have reduced, then you can attribute these to RSV. And a lot of these, you know, as I said, the mortality from RSV may not be directly from RSV. If the child gets RSV, then recovers, but then 2 weeks later gets a bacterial pneumonia and dies from that, then, you know, these deaths will get counted when you're doing these probe studies, which otherwise will not get captured.
Mm-hmm. Well, indeed, vaccines usually tell us more things than we actually know for the disease they prevent. So now that we are facing a new era, I hope that first that help us to solve the problem, no? And we will talk about this later, but indeed also to have a more accurate picture. But what about the others? Because you only mentioned so far infant mortality. Do we really have a good estimation for the adult population in terms of RSV burden and specifically mortality?
Yeah, so that again is a very interesting question and a very important question. So in children, we do know that RSV, particularly in the first year of life, is the leading cause of hospitalization in winters. And that is across all geographies. This is a common thing. In equatorial regions, it's year-round circulation that happens, so we don't see the winter patterns. But otherwise, it is the most common cause of hospitalization in respiratory hospitalization in very young children. But for the older population, when you start looking at hospitalizations and deaths, the degree of underestimation may be by the order of a magnitude or more, because what may be happening is, first, a lot of these people who get RSV and who die may be having other comorbidities. So they may be having underlying diabetes or cardiovascular conditions or COPD. And it's really difficult to ascertain what might be the cause of death in those people. They might have had RSV, but it's very likely that they might have never sought care. So RSV was never tested for, but never diagnosed. And therefore, the person dies maybe two weeks, 3 weeks after the initial infection with RSV. And at that time, even if you were to swab them, you're never going to find RSV in the respiratory tract. So this is the same problem that we have for influenza. For influenza, what we do generally are these models. Again, we have these modeling studies where we do these excess mortality and excess hospitalizations models, and we say that influenza results in between 200,000 to 500,000 deaths. These are the figures that the WHO give for seasonal influenza. But based on the modeling studies that have been done for RSV, particularly in Europe, what we do know is that RSV may be as important as a cause of death, comparable to influenza. So the RSV mortality is likely to be comparable to influenza. But when you start looking at the directly measured mortality or even modeled mortality based on the deaths in hospital where RSV has been identified, the numbers are very, very small. So what we look at is something between 20,000 and 50,000 deaths in high-income countries, but that is not the true mortality. The true mortality may be, as I said, maybe 500,000, but we really don't know, again, because of, you know, the adults shed virus for a very short period of time, the viral load is low in them, they don't seek care when they fall ill, they generally stay at home, so there are, and they have underlying comorbidities.
Yeah, and I think that also in this regard may influence the, I don't know if to say low awareness, but at least less commitment from the clinical practitioners with regards to RSV in the adult population, even that probably the clinical phenotype is different. It's not just influenza-like illness, but other forms of presentation and the recognition, probably not so frequent testing. And you have also reviewed that, no? And there are several publications from you and your group on the importance of the testing practice, no? Both in children and in adults, and even not only to do the testing, but how you actually do the testing, which tests and in which samples. No? So can you tell us a little bit more how this can influence, no? the results and, of course, the numbers we can actually are happening due to RSV?
Yes, so that's a very important point. So in children, generally, if you take a nasal swab or a nasopharyngeal swab, so that they will be, when they are shedding the virus, and which is for the first 7 to 10 days, you will identify RSV in the swab. But what we find is when you swab the older adults, then it's very unlikely that you may not, even if they had an RSV infection, they have an ongoing RSV infection, they will not be identified from a nasopharyngeal swab, even if you use a very sensitive diagnostic test like a polymerase chain reaction or PCR. But if you were to do some other tests, for example, serology, that will increase your yield. If you were to use some other samples like from the lower respiratory tract, for example, either saliva or sputum, then that increases your yield again. And so what you may find is that if you were to use a combination of tests, so for example, you used nasopharyngeal swab with saliva and sputum, then your yield could be 3-fold higher, and therefore you will be able to pick up more cases. And you're right that, you know, a lot of this is coming from lack of awareness, because a lot of the people who treat the older population are not aware. So the physicians themselves are not aware of the importance of RSV. And then the older adults themselves have not heard of RSV. This is a difficult name to pronounce. So that's a problem. I mean, flu, everyone knows. So everyone thinks that every time they get a bit of runny nose and body aches and some fever, they think that is flu. But a lot of other viruses other than influenza present similarly with this influenza-like illness symptoms. But also, I think the presentation, as you said, for RSV in older adults can be very varied. So some of them will have influenza-like illness symptoms, so body aches, fever, cough, cold, sniffles. But some may not present with any of these, and they may just be presenting, particularly the more frailer population, maybe presenting just with confusion, with falls, and no one sort of suspects if someone is sort of having falls or just confused. And in a very elderly person, 80-year-old person, one would not suspect RSV. So I think that is the other thing that is sort of going on.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we have seen now, because of the pandemic and that the multiple array testing, no, that RSV in many areas became like an emerging disease in the adult population, but it was always there. No, it looks like a new bug, but probably it's another sign that we were actually underestimating it, no, because of more frequent testing.
Yes. So more you look for a pathogen, more you will find. And I think, you know, in the sort of immediate sort of post-COVID period, suddenly people started realizing the importance of RSV, and then you were, especially in the U.S., people were talking about how they were having difficulty finding beds, when obviously there was a whole lot of susceptible population, and suddenly, you know, the children, very young children, some older children and older adults all started getting RSV, and the hospital beds started getting occupied, and there was no space, and they had to be airlifted to another hospital. So this all became a big media thing. But RSV was always there. It's a very stable virus. It comes and goes every year, and obviously there can be some variation year on year. But, you know, RSV, like influenza, comes every winter, and it does affect a substantial amount of population, both very young and then the elderly population.
Mm-hmm. And what about the gaps? Because no one knows better the epidemiology of RSV, and you are working for sure in many other aspects of RSV epidemiology, and that maybe you can advance us a little bit on what's next, or what are the gaps that we need to to look at, no, in terms of what we don't know, no, not only accuracy in some numbers, as we have already discussed, but which do you think are the main gaps and we should put more energy to try to fill them?
Yeah, so that again is a very important question. So one thing, what is sort of poorly understood, is what is the relationship of RSV to bacterial pneumonia? So we do know that influenza, post-influenza, you get bacterial pneumonias, particularly the 1918 flu pandemic that occurred. A lot of the deaths were not from influenza per se, but from the bacterial pneumonias. But what role does RSV do? Because, you know, especially in very young children, the immune system is not very well developed, so they are very susceptible to bacterial pneumonias. And in fact, if you were to look at some of the data that, again, from modeling studies that have been generated in the U.S. from Dan Weinberger's group, what you would find is that post the introduction of the pneumococcal vaccine, the RSV mortality and RSV hospitalization also decreased. So obviously, RSV mortality and RSV hospitalizations are closely linked to subsequent sort of bacterial pneumonias. But what we don't know is what is the relationship to the pneumococcal pneumonias, whether if you were to stop the RSV in the first instance, whether that will wipe out just not just RSV, but a whole lot of bacterial pneumonias. What will that do to the other viral infections? So will that have any cross-protection with flu? Again, we've seen some data from the flu vaccine trials, where is, you know, the flu vaccine trials that were done by Shabir Mahdi, they have shown that in fact, if you use the flu vaccine, you have an indirect impact, although low, but you still have an indirect impact on RSV as well. So I think, you know, these bacteria and these viruses, they are not operating in isolation. There is some kind of a synergy that is happening. They have a competitive spirit. They're playing as a team, and therefore, if you were to take out one or two of their star players, then possibly, you know, that will have an impact on the entire team and their team's performance.
I think you have raised an absolutely trending topic now, no? And even I could say something that may change the classical paradigm. No, we always tend to think this is virus, this is bacteria, and act according to that paradigm. But we are seeing that this interaction is much more complex. No, as a matter of fact, well, several lessons come from the COVID pandemic, and you have also published a lot of papers related to that. No, and even that, you already mentioned the link between RSV and pneumococcal pneumonia, but also the collaboration is very individual among bugs, I would say. No, that is not the sum of viruses or bacteria, but it's not a very specific and personal relation. No, even there are some epidemiological studies, some of them you have authored, showing that it's not the same to have RSV with methanomavirus and RSV with, rhinovirus or any other virus. So even this relationship is specific between viruses, not only with virus and bacteria.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a viral interaction is a very important topic. And again, people have shown that, you know, some of these viruses have very synergistic relationship. The presence of one helps in the colonization of the other virus. And then if one virus is present at a given time, it inhibits the growth of the other virus. So I think we've sort of seen that. That's the gap that we still don't understand. I think if we were to have an RSV vaccine, what will that do to a vaccine, to a virus like human metapneumovirus, because they are very closely related. They are, you know, first cousins, so to speak. So will it mean that the one that is remaining will fill up that space, or will that mean that the other one also is taken care of just by giving an RSV vaccine? It's something we don't know. I think a lot of the things are going to be very interesting when we start giving these vaccines to children and older adults, and we find that, you know, that has changed the the ecology in the respiratory tract, and you know, new things may emerge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's absolutely interesting, and we will be in the first line to see what happens. No? But I mean, if you reflect on the vaccines we already have in the short term, no, those that are already licensed, we know that we can expect an amazing impact, which is not a small thing, no. But the impact will be mainly on severe disease, so they won't actually impact infection itself. So in the case of passive immunoprophylaxis, either with maternal vaccine or the monoclonal antibodies, no, what we know is that they are very efficacious to prevent the severe forms of disease, but actually the children can get infected themselves. So it's a little bit tricky, no, how this will affect the interaction with the other viruses, or do you have any other guess in that regard?
So that is, again, a very interesting question. I think what the impact is going to be, as you rightly said, is going to be on hospitalizations from RSV. And I think that is what the payers care about. So the insurance companies or the healthcare systems care about, because that occupies beds, which they are very short during the winter months. Both for the maternal vaccine and also for the long half-life monoclonal, the data from the clinical trials show that the efficacy in terms of protection from severe lower respiratory tract infections, or if you were to take hospitalization as a proxy for severity, then that ranges from between about 77% in terms of the long half-life monoclonal to about 70% in terms of the maternal vaccine. And we are saying this is the efficacy up to 5 months or 6 months post-vaccination. So it does protect that population. But the interesting bit is that apart from protecting against RSV-specific lower respiratory tract infection hospitalizations, it also does protect against all-cause LRTI hospitalization. So mm-hmm. both from the Novavax trial, the vaccine obviously failed to make the primary endpoint, but there we had seen about 30% efficacy against lower respiratory tract infections. Again, with the long half-life monoclonal from AstraZeneca-Sanofi, we find a similar number. It's about 33% decrease in all-cause LRTI. And so that is more than what you would account for from RSV alone. And then all-cause respiratory hospitalizations in the first 5 or 6 months, there's a decrease of about 45% in from the use of long half-life monoclonal. So again, that means that the effect is going to be much larger than just RSV hospitalizations alone. It's going to have an impact on the wider, respiratory hospitalizations and also mortality.
Mm-hmm. Now we have already mentioned, no, the immediate opportunities we will have through maternal vaccination or the long-acting monoclonal antibodies. Let's reflect a little bit on what's next, no? And I think that's, again, another trending topic, and all countries are now discussing, no, what to do, how to do, when to start, who to target, no, and a lot of national authorities and regulatory bodies are starting to pronounce their own specific recommendations, no. So, what's your view in this regard? Before going to a specific recommendations, so what do you think is the ideal use of the available preventive measures in the infants, I'd say, and then we can talk later on the older population.
Yeah, so again, I think this is a very important thing. You've got two efficacious products. They are completely different. One is, both provide passive immunity, but one by immunizing the mothers and then transferring the antibodies passively from the mother to the infant, and the other is given to the infant after birth. And this is just the antibody that's been given. So, both of them will protect the children up until 6 months of age, maybe longer than that, but 6 months is what is the indication for which the licensure has been given. Now, the important thing is to get these immunization products into the arms of the babies. So Obviously, the high-income countries, both in Europe and in the US, they have moved quickly. And they have, you know, come up with recommendations. So the, you know, children are going to get the vaccines. The infants are going to get the vaccines this autumn winter. Whereas where the majority of the burden lies, you know, more than 95% of the cases are occurring in low and middle income countries. 97% of the deaths occurring in low and middle income countries. There it will take time because it's still these products have not yet been approved by the WHO, and they do require WHO pre-qualification. And after that, there has to be a Gavi support that is needed. So by that, it's another 3 years. Maybe 5 years before it reaches the low and middle income country. It has to be made affordable as well. So I think we are going to see some very interesting results from the first use of these products in European and American populations. And I think that will be quite a learning exercise because you have to integrate these vaccines into the existing immunization programs in the country, and you know how that is received by the parents. That's another conversation that we'll need to have.
Mm-hmm. No, I fully agree. And I hope that part of those data will come from Galicia, my region, that, as you know, we have been one, the very first to announce, and in fact, in few days, we will be starting the campaign. So I hope we can also generate some real life evidence about the use of this. But I have also a question, and it relates very much to also we have learned during the pandemic and the seasonality of RSV itself. No, we've seen temporarily disappear RSV, a change in the expected epidemiology. I think we are walking towards the return of the normal seasonality one way or another, but you can tell me what you think about that. But how does impact what we are going to do in terms of prophylaxis? And I'm bringing into the elephant of seasonal targeting practices or all year round prophylaxis.
Yes, so there are two aspects to this, and the first aspect is that do we know the RSV seasonality? Are we confident about it? And I think prior to COVID, for Europe, we knew what the RSV seasonality was like because, for example, in England, the peak RSV used to be in the December, January, and then, it was around the same time in some of the other Western European countries. But post-COVID, that the entire seasonality, as you said, was disrupted, and we started seeing RSV transmission occurring during the summer and early autumn. And obviously, that is one aspect to consider. But theoretically speaking, we may say that seasonal administration is going to be very effective because in terms of dose sparing or dose efficiency, so you're not immunizing children who were born at the end of RSV season because by the time the next RSV season comes, they are about 9 months of age, and therefore they probably are, their airways are bigger, their immune system is much more developed, they can handle an RSV infection, and they don't likely get severe infection anyway, then go to the hospital if they don't have comorbidities. But then seasonal administration does have a challenge. First, the season can be disrupted. You can have an early onset, that may happen. So you may plan for immunizing, let's say, from October onwards, but what if the RSV starts towards the end of September? Then that is a problem for you. The second challenge is to the healthcare workforce itself, and that is where I think most of the NITAGs, the National Immunization Technical Advisory Groups, are spending a lot of time thinking about how are we going to integrate into the existing immunization programs. Do we give the RSV on a seasonal basis? Do we give it at birth, just before discharge from the hospital? Do we run it in a special campaign mode? Do we give RSV maternal vaccine in the antenatal clinics? I think these are, and then the information that needs to be given to the healthcare workforce to start and stop the administration of the vaccine, if you're going down a seasonal route, is going to be quite complex. The other option is that we do it as a year-round vaccine. And I think if the vaccine is cheap, then it's a no-brainer. You can give it year-round. And in which case, if this is a longer duration vaccine, it will have some protection even beyond the 6 months or 8 months of life, and maybe that the children who are protected. Then there's also an argument around equity. So, and this is again, this comes up in the discussions at WHO and in NITAGs. If some children who were born during from September onwards get it, but what about those who were born in June, July, and they don't get it? Then the parents of those children may feel that they have been left out, and their children have been put at risk. So it's not being fair to everyone. So how do you deal with that, you know, argument of equity? And how do you convince people? How do you convince parents that actually you maybe your child didn't really need it, but you know, again, it's not as if children who are 9 months of age don't get hospitalized from RSV. They do. It's a much smaller proportion, but they do get hospitalized.
Well, I buy your argument on equity, and I understand it. But do you think it's the main driving thing? I mean, for example, no. Let's focus for a moment on the CCBI recommendations. No, in the UK, they really left open the possibility of a full year. Around approach versus the seasonal approach, no, and well, I think that is mostly based on cost efficiency than on the equity, no, and but it goes aligned with what you have just said, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in JCVI, this has been discussed quite at length around, you know, which of the approaches should we use, which should be preferred. And I think the scientists are on one side, people like you and me, and we can say from based on our, you know, modeling exercises and the theory that goes beyond behind this and say, look, this is what is going to be cost effective. But then I think when you talk to people on the ground who are delivering the vaccines, they say there are challenges to delivering something on a seasonal basis, and they generally don't like to do these on a seasonal basis. The other thing is that I think from a JCVI perspective, I think other countries would want to do as well, is they want to understand whether one approach is better than the other. I think, you know, in the UK, for example, we have devolved administration, so we have a devolved administration in Northern Ireland, we have one in Scotland, and one in England and Wales. And in fact, you could, do these different approaches. And that is something, again, that, you know, JCVI must have considered when they came up with the recommendation as they've sort of done. And I think they will come up at a later date with a much more firmer recommendation, but that may be based on evidence. At the moment, we don't have any evidence to say one is better than the other.
And going back to a comment you already made, no, that we are now facing two velocities, no, the developing countries and the less developed countries, about the possibility to really implement these opportunities, no, into their programs. And thinking about the EPI and the challenge we are facing, you already mentioned 2-3 years lag minimum, no, that to see where actually the children die and where the burden is absolutely the vast majority of RSV. How do you foresee that? What can we do better to accelerate this, or what are your prospects in this regard? No, about the opportunity and the challenge, no, to introduce these instruments into the EPI programs.
Yeah, so for the low and middle income countries, I think one of the major challenges that there has to be a certain pathway that needs to be followed. So there is the WHO pre-qualification that needs to be there for the product itself. It also requires the WHO SAGE recommendation, that is the Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization. That's an external group of experts who consider all the evidence and make that recommendation to WHO that, you know, that this should be introduced, this vaccine should be introduced into the expanded program of immunization, EPI vaccines in these low and middle income countries. Then they need the support from Gavi, who will help fund the introduction of these vaccines into the immunization programs. A lot of the countries, as they move from low income to lower middle income countries, they are graduating out from Gavi support, but introducing new vaccines into the EPI program brings a further challenge into the tight fiscal space that they've got. They don't have enough bandwidth to be able to add another vaccine into their immunization programs. And we do need to remember that most countries recently introduced the pneumococcal vaccine, the Hib vaccine, the rotavirus vaccine, and then the COVID vaccines. So it's the budgetary constraints are real, which are there. So they do need that Gavi support. And from a WHO perspective, the SAGE has said, look, the data that have been generated from these vaccine efficacy trials, the phase three trials, they are primarily from higher income countries. The LMIC data are few and far between, particularly, they are concerned about data from Africa and South and Southeast Asia, and that, they do want to see some demonstration studies, large scale studies in that population. And we do need to remember that particularly, there is a high proportion of malnutrition in Africa and South Asia. Africa has an added burden of malaria, and also which will have an impact on the maternal vaccine, but also of HIV. And, these are real challenges, and therefore those populations may behave in a slightly different way. The other challenge is affordability. So maternal vaccine, for example, is going to be supported. The introduction into LMICs is going to be supported through the Gates Foundation. So they are going to, they have made a commitment, and they've given a grant to Pfizer to produce these vaccines for low and middle income countries at an affordable cost. But for the monoclonal, that is unlikely at the moment that that is going to be affordable. So that is a question. I think that is the cost considerations, even in JCVI and other NITAGs that they are thinking about. Do we go for a monoclonal if we can have a cheap maternal vaccine? That's the thing. Even if one is slightly more efficacious than the other, but, that doesn't really sort of make much of a difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's really a very what you have just said, it's so important, and we hope we have some answers now, and we are able to reach the countries that need more these measures as soon as possible. And I would keep talking with you for hours, but before we finish, I think we need to touch upon the adult prevention also. Otherwise, they are going to point us as also missing the adults, in this regard. And I think there are also great news there with two vaccines licensed for the adult population. What are your expectations in this regard, and how do you use these vaccines in the adult population?
So again, I think a very important question. I think for the older adult population, the vaccine, we are probably in a much better space than we are for the infants, in the sense that we've got two vaccines, both pre-F vaccines that have now been licensed. In fact, they got licensed earlier. One of the vaccines from GSK got licensed earlier than the infant products. And countries are preparing for introducing these vaccines. I think the challenge is, again, the lack of burden data. So that has constrained both the ACIP in the US and JCVI and other NITAGs when they are making these recommendations. So both vaccines have shown high efficacy. These efficacy figures in the 80% after one dose, and in the older adult population against severe illness. And then and these vaccines have also been shown to be protective beyond the first year, just with one dose. So we've got 2 years worth of protection possibly from a single dose, possibly longer. So I think overall, we are in a much better space over there. So what the JCVI have recommended is for all adults over 75 years of age in the UK, we give a single dose of RSV vaccine, and then we will see how that goes. And similarly, in the US, the recommendation is for a slightly lower age. So, anyone over the age of 60 could get the vaccine. But then the challenges are around shared decision making that is there and how that works. So the patient and the clinician together make the decision to get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Well, as said, Haris, I would keep talking with you for longer, and it has been an absolute pleasure to have this dialogue with you, and I hope you also have enjoyed it. And thank you so much for your very insightful comments and discussion.
Thank you so much, Federico. I really enjoyed talking to you, and thank you again for having me.
Okay, thank you very much. And on behalf of the RSV Academy team, thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more discussions on the rapidly evolving and captivating world of RSV.
Thank you.